This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, it's All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today we're talking about control. The idea of control comes up a lot in psychology. Controlling behaviours, sometimes called coercive control, are a key part of family violence. But psychologist Professor Timothy Carey argues that control itself is not always a bad thing. He defines control as keeping things the way they are supposed to be. According to him, control is not only natural, it's essential to our health and well-being.
Control is a fact of nature. The same process that keeps our body temperature stable is the process that keeps our careers on track and our friendships the way we want them to be and our partnerships and marriages the way we want them to be and our bank accounts the way we want them to be. So being able to control the things that are important to us is the essence of well-being.
Professor Carey is currently the director of the Global Health Equity Research Institute in Rwanda. And we'll be talking more to Professor Carey about how he uses this understanding of control to treat his patients a bit later on. But first, let's look at what happens when the need to be in control, paired with a lack of empathy, becomes a problem. Controlling or manipulative behaviour is one of the key traits of a personality disorder called psychopathy.
Psychopaths, they are drawn to control. They are drawn to power. They are drawn to attention. It's a part of their narcissistic behaviour.
Thomas Eriksson is a Swedish behavioural expert who's researched the traits of psychopaths. It's estimated only around 1% of the world's population could be deemed psychopaths, though accurate statistics on this are difficult to capture. However, Thomas Eriksson says that psychopathic behaviour can still do a lot of harm to others.
They are very charming. They have this grandiose view of themselves. They are sort of more worth than you and I. They are above us. They are on top of the food chain. They have no remorse. They don't feel guilt for their own actions. They feel no empathy. They understand other people, but they don't feel anything, which is very important to understand the difference here. They can read you and understand when you're happy or when you are sad, but they don't feel the same emotions as you do. They lie. Lying is like breathing. Doesn't matter. They lie because it's fun to lie and see how far can they go. They can be very impulsive, lack of control of their own actions. And if they are caught, hey, that's a lie. They don't react. They are not, you know, embarrassed. They just turn on a coin and like, boom, 180 degrees. I didn't say that. You misunderstood me, you know. And then they can manipulate you, and sometimes they can confuse you so badly. They don't feel responsibility. They don't take responsibility for things. They happily blame anyone except themselves.
So you've been on the receiving end of psychopathic behavior. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I have been an author for 10 years, published author for 10 years. After my first book, a young woman contacted me using email saying she would love to be a writer as well. And as I was a bit attention-seeking, I admit, I answered her. Once and gave her a couple of advices, said, you can do this and that, and you keep up the good work, you know, and continue the struggle, and you will end up where you would like to be, and so on. And then she started to, it's a long-term conversation with me, and I refused to answer, because I usually only answer my readers once, because I need to set some boundaries there. But she didn't accept that, so she started to email my let's call it my wife. We weren't married, but still. And calling me things, you know, and started to actually stalk me in a really, really nasty way. So we had to bring in the police, and then everything stopped. And they said, we know she's lying, but she's doing it so perfectly. We can see she's lying. We can compare the facts, and we can see the schedules and things, because she was trying to say we were in this relationship. She was pregnant with my child, you know, and it was so bizarre, and contacted all my author colleagues in the whole country. Very embarrassing for me. And telling them lies and making things up, but in a very trustworthy way, so to speak. So some people called me up and said, hey, who is this person anyway? And I said, I don't know. This is really, really terrible.
Thomas Erickson's recently released book called Surrounded by Psychopaths, or How to Stop Being Exploited by Others, aims to make people more aware of and less vulnerable to extreme controlling and manipulative techniques.
Well, where should I begin? There are so many manipulation techniques. You can use something called, let's say, arbitrary positive confirmation to confirm somebody, to give somebody a positive feedback. They'll say, hey, you're really good at this and you look so beautiful. And, you know, now some might say, okay, is this manipulation? Well, depends on how you use it. Imagine a drug addict whose body is screaming for a certain drug. As long as he takes the drug, he feels okay. But if you take the drug away, he feels worse. And every drug dealer knows this. So you have the power over the drug addict because you are in control over the drug. You take this and put it in positive feedback. If I give you positive feedback and then I give you positive feedback and then I sort of comfort you and telling you all these beautiful things, how wonderful you are, and then I stopped all of a sudden, you will feel very, very confused. What happened? Doesn't he like me anymore? And then you ask me, hey, what's happening? And I refuse to answer. Then you will feel bad until I make you do something you don't want to do. And then I give you positive feedback again. It sounds really simple. And sometimes we do this with our employees or with our kids and so on. But it is a manipulation technique, actually. And then you can also turn it the other way around and call it arbitrary negative feedback, which means I will yell and shout at you until you do as I tell you, even though if it's a really stupid thing to do. Because some people react more to negative feedback than to positive feedback. It depends on who you are. And the psychopath, he knows who is sort of where your weak spots are. I am not so sensitive to negative feedback because I know sometimes I screw up things, and if somebody tells me to, you know, do better, I will listen. But I am a bit sensitive to positive feedback. I need this, you know, comforting things said to me. So then you have, of course, love bombing.
What's that?
Let's say you're single and you haven't met somebody who is your kind of person, and you feel a bit lonely and you feel a bit, you know, maybe your self-confidence isn't really high. And then all of a sudden you meet this man who tells you that you are the woman of his dreams. You are soulmates. You are so beautiful, and your personality is perfect, and you have this exact kind of humor that he wants. And, you know, you are everything he's always asked for. And he will tell you how fantastic you are and how much he loves you. Within a week, he will love you. And he will give you flowers and bring in presents. And he will pick you up with his car, you know, and he will invite you for fancy dinners. And, you know, and he will boost your ego. And you are the most fantastic woman on the planet. If you are not used to this, and if you feel a little bit unloved, if you know what I mean, you will fall prey for this. That is just what's going to happen. And then all of a sudden you feel, wow, I am living my dream life. I have this perfect partner. Oh, I love him. And then all of a sudden he turns it all the way around and starts to criticize you. And you will do anything to get back to hearing how beautiful you are and how fantastic you are.
Another technique is gaslighting. Could just explain what gaslighting is.
Gaslighting, it comes from an old movie with the Swedish movie star Ingrid Bergman. I think it's the early 1930s something. In the movie, her husband turned the gas lights up, and then he turned them down. And then she said, well, why are the lights changing? And he said, no, they are not changing. That's where the term comes from. But what it means is that it's all about confusion. Maybe your partner says, well, I'm going out with Mary. And your partner, you know, doesn't come home. And then you call Mary up and says, hey, have you seen Fred or whatever his name is? Oh, he hasn't been here all night, you know. He's not with me, Mary says. And then when he comes home, you know, smelling perfume maybe, you will say, you weren't with Mary. Where have you been? I didn't say Mary. I said Anna. You said Mary. I didn't say Mary. I said Anna. It sounds stupid when I describe this technique, but when you are the victim to these kind of confusion things many times, I mean, let's say, okay, maybe I said Mary, but I meant Anna. Maybe I said Marianne, you know. You are such a poor listener. It depends on who you are, because the psychopath will not manipulate everybody in the same way, because he will mirror himself in you and he will look for your weak spots. If it's jealousy, he will do something that makes you jealous and then tell you that you are jealous.
So that's one of the features that you talk about too, is that a psychopath will almost sniff out individual weaknesses in people.
Yes. It's like a wolf, you know, who will attack not the biggest sheep. He will look for the weak ones, the one with a bad leg. They will take the easy victim first. That's just the way it is. It's the same thing. Psychopaths are like wolves. They are predators.
In your book, you've decided to devote attention to two primary suspects, your partner and your colleagues at work. And this is very confronting thought for many of us. So where would you start assessing these two areas and whether you should be looking out for psychopathic tendencies in these two areas?
I am not trying to scare anybody or make people feel insecure, but I would like to point out there are some risks when it comes to partnerships. I have received a lot of emails. The book has been published in, I think, 25 languages before it will be published in English. And I get emails from basically all continents saying, wow, this wasn't really an eye-opener for me. I am living with a psychopath. I realize this now. What you should try to do when it comes to partnership, you should actually, if you feel something is wrong, it is probably wrong. If it looks too good to be true, it is probably too good to be true. But you need to be aware. You need to look at patterns, certain kind of patterns. Sometimes you need to see, I mean, we all lie sometime. Maybe it's white lies. Some of us are very really charming and so on. If you combine too many of the psychopathic traits on the psychopath checklist, you will see the pattern, but you have to look for it. If your partner makes you feel bad or makes you feel insecure or jealous or anything, you have to take a couple of steps back and sort of view the situation. What is happening here? What was it that actually started this emotion within me? Why do I feel like I do right now? What actually happened? And then you need to see the pattern. This happens every Friday night, or this happens every second week, or what is it? That's why it is so hard to see whether you are dealing with a psychopath or not, because they are using so many methods at the same time. You have to skip all the logical thinking. One guy I know who lived together with a female psychopath for many years, he started to recording their phone conversations in order to document what she actually had said, because she usually told him to, I didn't say that, you misunderstood me. No, that was not the point. And repeatedly, and he started to feel, it's too often she says, I didn't say that, but I know what I heard. So he started to record her, and then he played the recordings up to her, which he shouldn't have done, of course, because all hell broke loose. But you have to document things, at least to yourself, and then you have to be rational about it and say, hey, okay, I am living with somebody who might not be a clinical psychopath, but it's showing so many psychopathic traits, so I can't live in this kind of situation anymore, because I am getting hurt by this. My kids are getting hurt, my family around me are getting hurt, all my relatives are getting hurt by this person.
So manipulative behaviour generally is quite a human thing too, isn't it though? What are some of the ways that you can handle everyday manipulative behaviour without it necessarily being psychopathic behaviour?
That's a really good question. As you mentioned, all of us manipulate each other a little bit all the time. But the thing is, you can test it. You can confront and say, hey, stop it. Stop it right there. I feel manipulated by you now. When you do this, it makes me feel like that, and I'm not okay with that. If you are dealing with a psychopath, he won't care. If you're dealing with, let's call it, a normal person who maybe not be aware of what he or she is doing, he will say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't know that. And then the behavior will change. You have to bring it up on the table. You have to do something. Because if you feel bad, it is bad. You owe yourself to feel good. So confront the manipulator and say, I see through this. I understand what you are doing. It won't work anymore.
So what type of psychological support do people need and can they get, that those who've been damaged by psychopathic behavior?
I mean, the best thing is that you won't get caught in the web of a psychopath to begin with. And to avoid that, you can do a couple of things. You can, one, learn to know yourself really, really well. If you learn to know who you really are, you will also learn to see your own weak spots. Because a psychopath is looking for your weak spots. And if you know which one he's looking for, you know your sort of weaknesses, then you can keep control of this. So learn to know yourself and learn to understand what psychopathic behavior actually is. That's number two, understand what manipulation is. And number three is how much self-respect are you actually worth? So there you sort of building an immune system for not being manipulated really easy. But if you have been troubled by a psychopath or maybe even broken down, then it can be really hard to repair because you will maybe get burned out totally. This needs advanced psychological treatment. If it has gone so far, you nearly need to seek help.
Behavioural expert Thomas Erickson there. You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm. So as we've heard, controlling behaviour can be very harmful. But what if we take the very idea of control out of the realm of personality disorders and problem behaviour? After all, we all like to think we're in control of our lives. Clinical psychologist Professor Timothy Carey argues that we shouldn't see control as a dirty word. In fact, he thinks that understanding how control works is important for our psychological health and our relationships. I asked him why control, then, often seems to get such a bad rap.
You're absolutely right. We refer to people as control freaks if they seem too controlling. I think that it's got a bad rap because I don't think it's well understood. I think it's seen often as just that element that involves, you know, manipulation or people being kind of sneaky or underhanded or getting things the way they want them to be, which is certainly part of control, but it's much broader than that. So I think a lot of people react or recoil against being controlled. And so I think the idea of control has some negative connotations from that perspective, which I think is a real shame.
Because it does loom large, though, in situations of harassment and discrimination and bullying, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it becomes really interesting in those sorts of situations because the phenomenon of control is nothing more mysterious than the fact that we all have goals, the way we like to get to work, the time we like to be at work, the sort of job that we like, the sort of person we want to be, all of those kinds of things. And I think in a workplace, sometimes people have goals about how they can interact and what they can do with other people that are often inappropriate in terms of the rules of the workplace. But the people they're doing that to also have goals. They have goals about the way they like to be treated at work. And sometimes I think one of the difficulties that can occur is that when people are being bullied and harassed, it can set up a situation where the person might have a goal to avoid the bullying and the harassment, but also a goal to keep their job. And that can set up a really conflict situation for the person themselves, which can be really distressing and stressful.
So that push-pull dynamic that gets set up, both wanting to have control, how can we break out of that dynamic? What are the strategies that we can use to actually break it?
Yes, it's a great question. And a really good friend and colleague of mine, Rick Markin, and I wrote a book called Controlling People, The Paradoxical Nature of Being Human. And it's very much about that push-pull dynamic that as controlling systems, we like to control our environments. And a big part of our environments are other people. And the other people are designed just like us. So they are wanting to control as well. And so it doesn't take very long to figure out that part of our environment are other people, and trying to influence or control them is a big part of what we do. And the problem with that is that, just as you mentioned, there is this push-pull dynamic that can eventuate. And so the secret, I guess, of successful social living is really being able to find a way that I can control the things that are important to me without interfering with your ability to do the same thing. And often that's no more complex than negotiation and compromise and focusing on both of our goals and getting to a place where we call it going up a level or stepping back and finding those higher level goals where we might have some common ground or some agreement. And there's lots of things written about management in the workplace, for example, where some of the more progressive, I guess, management practices are all about stepping away from what we might call micromanaging. And micromanaging I see as being very controlling, where you try and control every little aspect of what the workers are doing. But other more flexible and responsive management practices involve stepping back a bit and negotiating with the people you're supervising what the goals of your work unit might be, and then really allowing the workers or the people you're supervising to determine their own ways of going about achieving those goals. So we can maybe both agree in the workplace that efficiency is important, and we might both share the goal of maximizing efficiency in our workplace, but how we go about doing that might be left to our own individual devices.
But there are people who tend to be more controlling than others. What causes someone to be overly controlling, no matter what the other person is doing?
I'd probably say in the first instance that we all control all the time from this perspective. So psychologists have something that they like to talk about called the biopsychosocial model. And one of the things I really like about this approach is that it's able to weave together all of the aspects of our functioning. So biological, psychological, and social functioning can all be understood as control processes. And it also helps us understand, so some people have what we might call really, really fine-grained ways about the way they like things to be, whereas other people have kind of broader ideas. So you might know of someone who, if you ask them what they like to do on the weekend, they have it all mapped out really specifically. They like to get up at a certain time. They like to have the newspaper in a certain way. They always have the same breakfast. They have their coffee the same way. And then after breakfast, they do a certain thing and then they do another certain thing. Whereas there are other people who are a bit like, oh, you know, on the weekend, as long as I don't get hassled too much, and, you know, as long as I catch up with friends at some point, and their goals are much more flexible and undefined. And sometimes that can be the difference in what we see as overly controlling people. The other aspect to that, though, that sometimes makes a difference is that there are some people who have lots of their goals are about what other people will do. So as a family member, for example, they might have goals about what their children will do or what their partner will do or what their parents will do even. But there are other people whose goals are much more about themselves and what they will do. So, for example, I could have goals about maybe even the sort of questions you would ask me today, and I could be thinking a lot about what you're going to be doing and how you will be presenting the interview. Or I could be thinking about the goals that I have and how I want to respond to whatever question you ask and so on. And I think just that difference in goals and where we focus our attention will have a big impact on the way that social relationships play out. So if, as a partner, I have goals about what my wife should be doing and the sort of meals she should be preparing and the time we should sit down at a meal and all those kinds of things, then I'll be acting towards her in a certain way to try and make those sort of things happen. But if instead I have goals about the kind of partner I want to be and how I can enjoy mealtime with my wife and so on, then my goals will be more about what I will do. And so there'll be quite a different flavor, if you like, or quality to the social interaction that we have, depending on where I'm focusing my attention.
So if that need to control does start to get in the way, say in the situation you just described, is there a way of helping somebody who feels like their partner, for example, is just trying to control them all the time and they just can't get out of it? What are some of the strategies that you can help with a dynamic like that between two people?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a big part of my work as a clinical psychologist, and the cognitive therapy that I've developed and I use is exactly based on this idea. So from a control perspective, the main problem in social relationships is one of conflict, where we have opposing goals. And the opposing goals can be between two different people. So I might want to drink a certain amount of alcohol each night, and my partner might want me not to drink alcohol. So that could set up a conflict situation where what I want and what my partner wants is at odds with each other. And that can be a useful way of understanding relationships. But what seems to happen far more commonly, conflict between people is obviously very serious. But often when there appears to be conflict between people, what it can actually boil down to is a conflict just in one person's mind. So I might want to be really close to my partner and her to be really affectionate towards me, but I also might want to drink as much as I want to drink. And I want to clarify at this point, I don't think I have any alcohol problems, but this can be a common scenario where someone loves their partner and wants to stay in the relationship, but also might want to leave the relationship because they don't like the way their partner treats them at times. So the problem can certainly partly be around the way their partner is treating them. But the problem that is a lot more interesting and often helpful to focus on is the individual person's own conflict around whether they stay or leave, basically. And that, in the work that I do, that's a big focus of our work. And that's often involves people considering both goals, the goal to stay and be with their partner, and also the goal to leave and be separated from their partner, but then looking at what's behind those goals. So people have goals of turning up to work at a certain time because that helps them achieve their goal of being a good worker, and that helps them achieve their goal of getting the salary that they want, and that helps them achieve their goal of progressing in their career, and so on and so on. So my goal to stay with my partner might be related to goals of being looked after in my old age and feeling a sense of closeness and intimacy and so on. But my goal to leave might also have to do with goals around feeling good about myself and not feeling belittled and put down. So that goal can be related to living the life I want to live as well. And so in this approach, helping people focus on both of the opposing goals and the goals that are often in the background, the kind of more important, highly valued goals that are influencing both of these goals, can often help people kind of find a way through the conflict.
Professor Timothy Carey, Director of the Global Health Equity Research Institute in Rwanda. And look out for my extended interview with Timothy Carey about how he's applying this perspective on control to address inequality in Rwandan society. It's available as an All in the Mind podcast extra. If you or anyone you know is affected by family violence, call 1-800-737-732. That's 1-800-RESPECT. Thanks to the team, producer Jane Lee and sound engineer Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.